Now, moving on to today's roundtable, we've got reaction to the deadly shootings at Virginia Tech. Plus, can civil rights law protect you from racist language at work? Joining us today to talk about these stories and more are Bob Meadows, writer for People magazine, Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, and Chicago Sun-Times columnist Laura Washington. Welcome, everybody, and let's just quickly take a look at the situations in New Orleans. Earlier, we heard from a New Orleans native living in Houston. She can't afford to return home, and should people at this point begin to just resign themselves to not necessarily moving back to their beloved hometown, or is it still time to fight the good fight? Laura?
Well, I think many people have already done that, Faraya. There's a significant community in places like Houston. There are folks here in Chicago who have moved on with their lives, who found, you know, connections to family, to job opportunities, to things in many cases that these working poor families could not find in New Orleans, and they're thriving, or they're at least they're on an even keel. But to answer your other question, of course, for folks who want to come back to in many cases these are, you know, multi-generation families who have been pushed out of New Orleans, they should have the opportunity to come back. The problem, of course, is so obvious. It's much bigger than housing. It's about jobs. It's about economic development. It's about the city's infrastructure. And I think one of the challenges that New Orleans has not met yet is trying to address all of those issues and see that this is an organic problem and not something you can just do with patchwork.
Well, Michael, what do you think about that? Is it something that really is requiring a big government intervention at this point, or are people making up their own minds individually?
I don't know what the government is doing that makes sense in this regard, because I think they're trying to pander and appeal to their constituency and at the same time deal with economic realities and the aftermath of a natural calamity. And a lot of people who are have been the victims of that natural calamity are not facing realities. I mean, these perpetual vouchers and perpetual welfare programs is not getting your life together. You know, I guess it is possible to be happy and poor and segregated in New Orleans. I want to go back and be poor and happy and segregated in New Orleans. But people want to have a different kind of vision for themselves and for their families than that. And therefore, the people in New Orleans who are trying to bring a different New Orleans into existence, I think are absolutely right. You need mixed housing. As Laura said, you need economic opportunities. You need jobs. You need education to prepare people for jobs. And you need rehabbing public housing. And you certainly do need public housing because if New Orleans is going to be redeveloped and gentrified, the prices are going to go sky high. So you do need public housing. But you don't need segregated public housing. You need a new town approach. Get real.
Well, Bob, who's going to create that new approach?
That's the big question. Bringing a new New Orleans, how can you do that? A couple months ago, I was speaking with the Lieutenant Governor Mitch Landrieu down there, and he was talking about this as well. He wanted to bring people back. He wanted to do all these things, and I said, well, you know, New Orleans was one of the most crime-ridden cities prior to Hurricane Katrina. Mm. If you redo it, how will you actually know it's a success if you restore it to what it was before? Is that really a success? You look at New Orleans right now, crime is even higher than it was then. And yeah, it's fine to want to bring in all this new public housing and all these things, but as Michael just said, keeping people on assistance and keeping people in these Maxine Waters said permanent Section 8 program. Permanent? That's not what we want. We don't want people on permanent. And so I think, sure, you want to go home, you want to return, but what are you really returning to? The reason they wanted to tear down all this public housing is because once they went in there, they saw how decrepit it actually was. We've all been to New Orleans. We've all stepped outside the French Quarter, and you could see the poverty there was just unfathomable practically. Is this what people really want to go back, or is it just the road colored glasses that we put on when we're no longer in the situation that we once were used to?
I think we need to move ahead to, of course, a topic that's really got a lot of people thinking, praying. Moving on to the shooting at Virginia Tech. First, I want to reintroduce everybody. This is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We were just hearing from Bob Meadows, writer for People magazine, Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, and Chicago Sun-Times columnist Laura Washington. Officials have made it clear that this is a student that we're talking about, which is, I'm sure, going to add another layer of distress to the whole mass shooting. Sung Hui Cho, a registered alien of Korean nationality, a student. And there have been many different angles on this. I don't think that it's going to be quite a while before we know all of the different ins and outs of why this happened or the pattern, the police response. I mean, I guess at this point, considering that this is not just the worst school shooting, but the worst shooting spree in American history, what can we learn, first of all, Michael, about how schools need to respond? Because a lot of times when we think about school shootings, we may think of, oh, dangerous urban schools, yeah. And we may think of middle schools and high schools, not of colleges as much. But when there are these incidents on high school or college campuses that are so very bloody, they are far beyond in scope of the number of victims, anything that happens on a more regular basis.
The first lesson we can learn is to stop the blame game, the instantaneous blame game. Oh, the school authorities didn't respond to it quickly enough. They didn't have a plan in place. Police didn't tell everybody. People told them to stay in buildings, and then they stood at the windows because they wanted to see what was going on in campus. People didn't have cell phones. The blame game goes on and on. What we know is this, as we usually know, almost immediately. In this case, it was a lone gunman. No doubt. The young man, has psychological problems. Beyond that, there is nothing else to say. And I don't think that this is a college campus situation. And campuses are quite different from urban high schools because they are really suburban sprawl. And it's difficult, if you've ever been on a college campus, to know what's going on across the way, across the dormitory, across the campus. And so I don't believe in engaging in the blame game. I think this was a troubled student, and the consequence is obvious.
Bob?
You know, as one of the things that I was thinking about this is that the students who are in this school right now were probably in middle school during Columbine. And I was just wondering to myself, you know, what is this? This is now how sort of you grow up in America, because all that rash of school shootings that we had back in the mid to late 90s, and so it's become almost just a part of who we are. I agree with Michael that I don't want to play the blame game either, because when it's somebody inside the campus, if it was somebody outside the campus, in fact, Virginia Tech responded marvelously last August when the prisoner escaped and they closed down the campus. Ended classes that day. But when it's somebody already inside, there's really not that much that you can do. And it was perhaps a domestic thing. And so, sure, you typically think in that case that that's the only person that's going to be attacked.
Isolate.
And then the student, but obviously the tragedy that followed. But I think one of the things, you know, there has to be, we as humans, we forget. There has to be emergency procedures in place. You have to practice them, actually. You have to plan for the worst possible thing that could happen, and you have to practice that. I'm sure a lot of the people who once had parachutes and emergency things in their skyscrapers here in New York City probably don't even know where those are anymore.
Well, let's move on to hear a little bit from Charles Steger. He is the school's president, and this is his response to why the school didn't shut down earlier.
And classes start at 8 a.m., thousands of people are already in transit. So the question is, where do you keep them where it is most safe? We had some reason to think the shooter had left the campus, in fact, may have been leaving the state, and this other event occurred 2 hours later.
Laura, it strikes me that a lot of times parents and students mourn the days when you could go to a big urban high school and there would be no metal detectors. Is this kind of a shooting going to be something that is viewed as a one-time tragedy, or do you think that campuses, college campuses, ones that have generally placid environments, are going to start taking some of these more extreme security measures?
I think that, yes, the answer to your question is yes. And I teach on a college campus at DePaul University, which is in the city, it's the center of the city of Chicago, but it's also very urban, and it's also in a middle to upper middle class community. And I think there you'll see a mindset that I think has got to change. And the mindset is around guarding against one-on-one types of crimes. You'll see, if you walk around campus, you'll see posters everywhere. There was a mugging here. There was an assault there. Beware. And that, of course, those are things you need to be concerned about in an urban environment. But these bigger crimes, these crimes that are not as easy to identify, there's no way we're ever going to be able to identify a shooter like this before the fact, as we've learned time and time again. Psychiatrists will tell you there's just nothing that can – there's sometimes there's warning signs, but usually you always hear the stories afterwards. I didn't see it coming. The guy said he was depressed. I didn't really take him seriously. So you're not going to be able to identify the shooter or the danger. You're not going to be able to do much about gun control. So you need to be able to be as conscious of the systems that need to be in place and the pervasive, broad-based kinds of security that I think that campuses have not really been looking at. They've been looking, again, at more of that personal security issue.
But you're not going to shut the campus down because a student is depressed. You shut down most
no,
all
I'm,
of
I'm
campuses.
No, I'm saying you're not going to know that student is depressed, Michael. That's the point. You've got to guard against that possibility always.
Bob, I guess I'll let you have the last word on this one. Looking at this from the perspective of what the president has been saying, do you think that this is going to rekindle a debate on gun control?
Well, the debate on gun control has never ended, of course, and this will just probably feed both sides. The people in favor of gun control will say, yeah, if he hadn't had a gun, if he'd had a baseball bat or a knife, he wouldn't be able to get to as many people. And the other people will say, yeah, but, you know, if a student had been carrying a gun, they would have been able to shoot him right away. So take him down Wild Wild West style. So This is just going to perpetuate the argument that has continued as long as there have been guns.
All right. On that note, joining us from NPR's New York studios were Bob Meadows, writer for People magazine, and Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition. Also joining us from the Windy City, member station WBEZ, Chicago Sun-Times columnist Laura Washington. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you.
And as always, if you'd like to comment on any of the topics you've heard on the roundtable, just give us a call at 202-408-3330. That's 202-408-3330. Or you can send us an email. Just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. Please be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.